Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon. It's quite common to want to escape the daily grind, but what might happen if you actually acted on it and dropped out without any plans to return? That's the premise of Wakefield, a new feature film by Robin Swecourt. It is based on a story by E.L. Doctorow and stars Bryan Cranston and Jennifer Garner. Wakefield opens today at the Landmark Sunshine Theater. It's also available on video on demand, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Ms. Swecourt and Mr. Cranston to our show. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back. In your case, Brian, welcome back. Robin, when did you first read the short story by E.L. Doctorow?
I read it in The New Yorker in 2008.
And did you think immediately that might work as a movie?
I don't think that was my immediate thought, but I did connect to it very deeply, and I had images come into my brain as if I had seen a movie, and I thought a movie had already been made of the short story.
Didn't Doctorow actually draw inspiration for Wakefield from a work by Nathaniel Hawthorne?
He did. He reached back to 1835 and found the story that more or less invited him to do his own version of the story.
Well, of course, E.L. was just a child at the time in 1835. So.
Yeah, well, he was being called Edgar in those days. When you met with Doctorow, did you get in touch with him and say, I think I might want to adapt this into a film?
I did eventually. I was actually introduced to him by one of my producers, Elliot Webb, who had been an agent at ICM and had become a producer. So he knew Doctorow a little bit.
And what were his thoughts on transforming it, adapting it into a film? Because a lot of writers get uncomfortable about that. They see all sorts of changes being done to the basic ideas.
Well, fortunately, this was not Doctorow's first rodeo. He had had other movies made out of his books. And he had
a couple of hit movies.
And he also had friends who were in the filmmaking world. And so it didn't seem like a situation in which he was taking a trip to a faraway land. He was very comfortable and really open to all of my ideas.
Do you think there's any significance in Howard's last name, the character's last name, Wakefield?
I sort of felt some significance there. I mean, I don't know what the intention was on Doctorow's part, but for me, it is about a man who is waking to himself.
Brian, how did you get involved in this film?
I have to think about that. I think Robin had some discussions early on, and it came through my agency and back about 3 years ago when I was doing a play out of town in Boston, and I read it and it resonated with me, and I was kind of torn by it, by the delicacy of it and the fact that this man is not necessarily a great guy, but I felt he was honest in who he was.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Do you have to like a character on some level in order to play him? Because
no.
Howard Wakefield is not all that likable.
No, I don't.
Although
think,
we might understand his urge to escape.
Yeah, I don't think likability is a prerequisite to playing a character like this. And I think that's where the terms of protagonist and antagonist have kind of merged into this weird definition. Like a protagonist has to be a likable person, not necessarily. It has to be the person who's driving that story. And I think the most important thing is not necessarily seeking likability, but seeking honesty and seeking relatability for an audience.
Howard didn't plan his escape in advance. He just acted on a sudden impulse. But then he decided to continue to stay in the garage day after day, hiding away.
I think it's a very understandable position. I don't know that anyone in our modern world wouldn't love the opportunity to push the pause button on their life and just take a break, just be able to inhale and exhale. And
but
that's what he wanted.
In this case, isn't he Breaking Bad?
You snuck that in. Look at you. You clever man. Yeah, you know, I mean, I think like those characters, I think there's a relatability to it. And I think that's what Howard Wakefield initially wanted to do, was just take a breather from his life and step back and let everything calm down a little bit. Unfortunately, a turn of events, and he was not able to make a re-entry into his life.
And we don't want to spoil things. Reveal too much of what
goes on.
No, let's let the audience have the fun.
When did you realize that Brian would be really good for this role?
Well, almost immediately. I finished the script in 2012, and within about 4 weeks, I gave it to a casting director and said, I need to make up a very short list of people that you really respect. And I told her the kind of actor I was looking for. She gave me a tiny list, and the very first name on it was Bryan Cranston. And I called her up and said, I didn't have to get past one. Wow. I think that he would be perfect. That's who I want. And so began this discussion.
And then Jennifer Garner plays his wife, Diane. Was she near the top of the list as well?
She should have been. Yes, she was very, very close to the top of the list, if not the top. We didn't really rank that list. We were just sort of jotting on a napkin. It was not too long before we went into production, because that's not the kind of role you can cast years in advance.
Her character is only seen through Howard's perspective. How do you convey that cinematically?
Well, it is a tremendously subjective film. A lot that happens in the film is completely from Brian's point of view, including his interior life. We see things that he's thinking about.
So he does that in voiceover.
He does it in voiceover. You see these sort of flights of fancy that he has. We have his memories. We're very much locked in his head. And we had an opportunity with this film to do something kind of unusual, which is to see how this person's view of someone began to change over time because he was changing, not because she necessarily was changing that much.
Well, this does happen in many, perhaps most marriages. We grow differently. Mm-hmm. Then part of the struggle is to find a way to remain connected. But it's never the same as it was when you first met.
No, I know. And in Wakefield, in casting someone like Jennifer Garner, who is generous of spirit and available emotionally and sweet and beautiful and all those things, it also puts an added pressure on the audience to understand the reconciliation of Howard Wakefield's actions. Hmm. Why would he be avoiding this lovely woman? And it's
causing her pain.
Because it just goes deeper. It's a deeper level of understanding.
Right. Do you rehearse when you do a film like this?
We did. Usually you don't have a lot of opportunity to do that, but the type of person I am as an actor and the type of person that Robin Swycourt is as a writer-director, we knew that we wanted to steal some time, so off the books we were getting together as just two friends to talk. And what we started the rehearsal process is going through to make sure that we're on the same page, that I understood every intention of where she was going with all the nuanced changes that you had.
I've always wondered why there aren't more rehearsals in film, because it allows for a shorter shooting schedule, doesn't it?
I can't imagine not having had that rehearsal time and having to make this movie in 20 days. It just
would have been... You made it in 20 days because of the budget?
Because of the budget. It would have been impossible to make this without having that time where we went intensively into the script together.
Mm-hmm. For much of the film, you're looking out the window and watching your family, observing them go through their daily routines and worrying about where your character has gone. Were you actually looking through a window?
Well, I was looking through a window. Unfortunately, I wasn't looking at them.
So you were reacting to something that wasn't there?
Well, technically, yes, but emotionally, no. Fortunately, Robin structured the shooting to have that take place last. So everything that was shot that I was looking at was available on screen and on a monitor. So before each scene of me being alone in my attic looking out at a tape mark, we reviewed what was already shot, and Robin and I discussed it, what was just happening, what is going to happen next. And so I had a a good armament of ideas going into the scene.
The reason I ask is actors have often told me that part of acting is reacting to the person you're playing a scene with or the people you're playing a scene with. In this case, you're playing a scene with Tape Mark.
Right, but Brian was holding it in his mind. That was what was fantastic. All that preparation allowed him to just come on with these images fresh in his mind and be able to start reacting to his what he was remembering.
I'm speaking with Robin Swycourt, whose latest feature film is Wakefield, based on a story by E.L. Doctorow, starring Bryan Cranston and Jennifer Garner. Bryan Cranston is also here. And Robin, as we've said, it's difficult to find Howard likable. Were you worried about how audiences might react?
Yes, I would say that there were moments, particularly in the editing room, where that was on my mind. But at the writing level, I knew that I had to build into the script the most human moments with him at the beginning, because I knew that if people connected to him, one human being to another, that whether they liked him or not was really going to be irrelevant. It was whether or not they felt aligned and connected to him.
And I understood some of the feelings he had that led him to do what he said.
We've all had those feelings. And so by kind of front-loading that a little bit in the script, then it was just about looking at Brian's performance in the editing room and making sure that we dwelt on the most human aspects and not his most unpleasant aspects as a character.
So what's happened when you've screened the film for audiences? What kind of reaction have you gotten?
You know, we've gotten very strong positive reactions to my relief and delight. We finished it 4 days before we went to Telluride with us. So the first thing that happened to me was I came out of a dark room and put it in front of 650 people in a theater, which should have been terrifying, but I was so exhausted and shell-shocked. I didn't have any anticipatory anxiety. And I was so gratified that people laughed in the places that I wanted them to laugh, and they felt the emotions I wanted them to feel. And there's a kind of gasp and shock of recognition at a certain point in the story. It's almost like a magic trick. You hope that this will happen.
Brian, you've played quite a few disturbing characters successfully.
Oh, thank you.
those are the meatier roles, aren't they?
Yes, I suppose.
But it's easy to play a handsome, lovable person.
Well, it is for you. You're like a model.
Thank God this is radio.
I don't look for a disturbed character. I just basically, if it moves me, it's quite simple. I mean, I trust my instincts. When I read a script or a play, it's no different from anyone in your audience reading a good novel. You can't wait to get back to it and read the next chapter. And that's the same thing with actors when we're looking for a product. Stories to tell. It's what moves me, what resonates.
Did you find any similarities between Howard and Walter White, who also drops out, although in a very different way?
You know, I think that's probably better for scholars who have more of an objective eye.
Somebody in grad school is already doing a
paper on it. It doesn't help me to try to spend any time looking at that, so I just kind of go to the next job. I don't look back too often.
Although you've also worked behind the camera, do you want to do, as so many actors want to, do you want to direct?
Oh, yeah, and I have. Mm-hmm. I've directed a lot of television. I did a little independent feature about 12 years ago, and I have another script that I wrote that I would love to direct at some point, hopefully next year.
Aren't you also a spokesperson for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children?
I am.
There are scenes here with children with Down syndrome. That's just coincidental.
It is. It's beautiful. I mean, that's what Robin wrote, is that it's a slice of life, that there are people who have all different kinds of either learning disabilities or physical disabilities that are part of our world. And one could say that Wakefield himself has some sort of disability. What's great about Wakefield and what Robin was able to put together in the final analysis is that at the end of watching this movie, Wakefield, people will begin the conversation about what they just experienced. And I think that is the measure of success.
Robin, did you come through directing through script writing?
Yes. I had done some directing of little short films when I was in my 20s, but where I made my career mostly was as a screenwriter. There weren't a lot of doors open at that time for women to move into directing, but as soon as I was able to, I did begin to direct.
And you helped launch the Hedgebrook Screenwriting Workshop.
That's right. That's focused on women who might otherwise be shut out of the film business.
But we're seeing more and more women, as you say, getting into managerial roles. We had Sherry Lansing on our show recently.
Mm-hmm.
She ran two major studios.
Right. The first place where women were sort of welcomed into the film business was on the business end as executives and development executives. But in the creative side, we are lagging tremendously in every creative endeavor.
This is your first film in 9 years. Is that
as a
because
director,
of
yeah.
that problem? A director.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that?
Yes,
is it hard to get funding?
Yes, it is. In fact, there's an initiative that Sundance has organized with Women in Film, which is a fund to try and help women get their second movie, because it's almost impossible. The first one, you can beg, borrow, and steal and get friends to do, and then even if it's successful, it's very hard to get that second movie. And it was hard for me.
Unless the first movie was such a giant hit that they had no choice in the matter.
Right, but I think we can look at what happened with Catherine Hardwicke and Twilight and know that it isn't always the case.
Hmm. So it's still, Hollywood is still a men's world. We've been talking about racial politics in Hollywood. Should we be talking more about sexual politics in Hollywood?
I think inclusion is the word that I go to over and over, that we're shutting out voices that we need to hear from.
Mm. My great thanks to both of you for being on our show. The film Wakefield opens today at the Landmark Sunshine Theater, also available on video on demand. It stars Bryan Cranston. It was written and directed by Robin Swycourt. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Harold Evans quotes from Charles Dickens to describe the current state of the English language: fog everywhere. From Facebook posts to news reports, software agreements to advertising copy, political speeches to insurance forms, unintelligible writing is everywhere. Harold Evans is a legendary editor and writer who was knighted for his service to journalism. His new book, Do I Make Myself Clear? Why Writing Well Matters, is both a guide and a manifesto. It's published by Little Brown. I'm very happy that it brings Sir Harold Evans back to our show. Welcome back.
I'm honored to be back.
And I hope that you can tell from that intro, where I use the word everywhere twice, that I don't suffer from monologophobia. Is that a word you invented?
No, I wished I had. The word was invented by Theodore Bernstein of the New York Times. And the definition of it is a monologophobe who practices monologophobia. It would be rather caught naked outside Saks Fifth Avenue than use the same word twice in one paragraph. And what he was getting at was, I have examples throughout the book that will refer to, say, a Ted Cruz, a candidate you may remember in the distant past of the 2016 election, and next time will be called a businessman or a Christian or something, but he won't retain his identity. So at the end of a bout of monologophobia, which is very catching, you're wondering, who the hell is this? Because it's changed. Mm. I have another example of a writer or a reporter, or a speechmaker, actually, frightened to use the word Crimea twice in the same sentence, so it becomes the Black Sea Peninsula. Wait a minute, are we still on the same page?
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with using it as long as it doesn't sound like you're just leaning on it.
Exactly. And the invention of alternatives is actually worse than the repetition of the name.
It often sounds
because
tortured.
The alternative that throws you. And often one is puzzled about how to... people are frightened of boring the reader. You won't bore the reader. It's much better to bore him than to mystify him.
With all the problems we have today, how much concern should we have about whether something is written well or not?
Oh, my heavens.
getting right to it, Harry.
It's much writing well is much more than a linguistic or grammatical element in language. To me, it's a moral issue when language is used to deceive, as it has been and is being, for instance, in the fulfillment of promises of health policies, insurance policies. And when the language is not merely obscure, but deceptive, as it is in many of these policies, and many tragedies occur. One of the great tragedies of our time, when 124 people were killed in General Motors cars, was because the first intimation of the problem with the airbags was to say it was a question of consumer convenience and comfort. It wasn't. It was a question of safety. And safety was a word that was verboten.
Don't you also argue that bad writing was in part responsible for the Great Recession of 2008? Now, was that bad writing intentional, intended to mislead, or is it just that some things aren't written well?
Everybody was in the act. The millions of people who signed mortgages, they hadn't understood and probably didn't get to the end of the contract for fear of being impaled on a lien, as it were. Many people didn't finish. When they tried to finish, the language was so confusing. And as we know from The Big Short, an excellent movie, by the way, and an excellent book, people were generally trying to deceive people to sign more stuff and more stuff and more stuff. And the masters of the universe didn't understand what they were doing either.
But we also tend to trust the people who put those things in front of us. When your cell phone suddenly has this thing that goes on and on and on and on and on and on with a little button that says agree at the end, you don't read all of that six-point type.
No, quite right. That is one of my nightmares, because most of us don't get to the end of those clauses and contracts. And Silicon Valley has a lot to answer for. Even the great Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook, when he does his annual report, he's talking in a language he's almost alien. He doesn't talk about people on Facebook. He talks about such users. Mm-hmm. When they discovered that such users, i.e. you and me, were in a different location, then we get a long, convoluted sentence about it. Instead of the same when he says that we've had a lot of complaints, instead of saying, this is bad for us, which is just enough, it goes on, this considering the effect on our revenues and our reputation, and da 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 da. So excess wordage is often one of the reasons I'm pressing.
Is he doing that on purpose, you think, to
obscure? No. Somebody's probably written it for him. I mean, Leonard.
May have written it for him?
Oh, somebody written it for him. The point is, what I'm trying to get is that it's hard to be concise when you're trying to wrap things up. And business is the worst offender. There's a friend of mine who's done very well. He was asked to go to a liquidation event. What was a liquidation event? It was the business term for the selling his company. Mm-hmm. Why don't you say, come and discuss the sale of your company, instead of come to our liquidation event? I mean, it's full, and business is absolutely terrible. Take any annual report, and almost anybody can see that it's convoluted and obscure when it should be. The best person, of course, is Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett says we had a very bad year. This is why we had a bad year. You don't get that. You get adverse consequences that will follow from this. So people get very irritated and suspicious of business contracts and business language, partly for the good reason that they're often obscuring things that should be clear, and partly because it's so confusing.
My guest is Harold Evans, whose latest book is Do I Make Myself Clear? Why Writing Well Matters. It's published by Little Brown. This is WMIC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You seem to be suggesting that the best writing is the writing that sounds most like speech.
That's an interesting point. I'm talking about...
Because Warren Buffett is writing the way that he would talk.
Yes, exactly. I'm not suggesting that a novelist should be as concise and is, in fact,
you
simple
allow
language.
Metaphors and similes?
Pardon?
You allow for metaphors and similes?
Of course, and simple metaphors and similes.
Although anything you don't like adjectives and adverbs.
Yeah, well, anything that makes the meaning clear and improves understanding. Now, George Orwell, of course, did that. If you read Orwell on the English language, he's asking you to be clear. There's a wonderful new book out about Churchill and Orwell.
We had Thomas Ricks on our show today.
Yes, exactly. So that what I'm arguing about and what I'm trying to get over is the fact that people get frightened of grammar. So they start introducing clauses and things. James Thurber went mad when he was trapped inside a which clause. Don't worry about the which clause, isn't that and which and whom. And no linguist will really quarrel with me for saying this, but it's much better to try and make your words clear and follow your instincts about what is clear and don't worry too much about that and which.
Now, can good writing be taught?
Yes. There's a wonderful example. There's a book out in Britain by somebody who's analyzed Our God, Shakespeare. And he goes through Shakespeare from the very early plays and language, and it's very often based on Plutarch and the lives of Plutarch. And so he finds passages which are basically lifted. And then he shows how, in this marvelous book on the eloquence of Shakespeare, he shows how all the devices, all the genius of rhetoric is employed by the bad she sat in was of burnished gold, alliteration, B. But it's more than that, because, of course, Shakespeare is not just a wordsmith, he's a moralist. And so what makes Shakespeare so memorable is not only the quality of the language, it's also the perception of moral character.
But he also had iambic pentameter. Hmm? He had iambic pentameter to help him along.
Yeah, well,
along.
You see, there you go. You see, iambic pentameter, don't ask me to define that now. So I just know when I hear friend. By the way, one of my exciting experiences in life was to be with Marlon Brando, because I published his book. And friends, Roman countrymen, lend me your ears. Why did Marlon, to me, emphasize the word lend? Because he's in a crowd of murderers who would kill him just like that, as they killed Caesar. But he's only there asking you to lend me your ears, because I'm going to go and I'm going to make love to Cleopatra.
You were a junior reporter on a weekly newspaper at 16. What was your job, and do you think that you wrote well at that point?
My job then, it was actually one of the reasons I've written this book. My job was, I did phonetic shorthand. I was 120 words a minute shorthand, 80 words a minute typing. I had gone through business college. I'd left school at 15. So my job was to take down in shorthand every single word said in the law court, every single word said in the council meeting, and then transcribe them for the big boys back at the office, the reporters. And I got immense frustration that the verbosity so was planted in my soul was a hatred of verbosity and circumlocution and a desire for conciseness. So I went through all the speeches and wrote them up as concisely as I could. And the difference was not only a saving in my temper, but also a huge saving in the time and effort of the reader.
Aren't newspaper journalists kind of taught to think that way because there are often space concerns?
Well, there are space concerns, of course, yes. When I was talking about working on a weekly newspaper and then an evening newspaper, we were dealing with hot metal type. And I constantly was told, it's not rubber, you know. You have to fit this particular space. And so I learned early on to fit the space. Now, on the web, you don't have to fit the space. You can go on and on and on and on and on and on. And you don't have to pick up the actual
unless
structure.
You're tweeting, of course.
Well, tweeting is 147 characters. You know what tweeting is good for? Assertion. It's not any good for argument, not any good for reasoned argument. So it's all right for Mr. Trump to tweet, but it's a mere assertion of one statement against another. It's not advancing human knowledge. In fact, of course, as we know, and I wonder if I might, I would love to read something written by an Englishman about Mr. Trump. Is that possible?
Of course. We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll have you read that.
Okay.
But when you were at the Manchester Evening News, didn't you write a daily pronouncement on whatever the editor thought was the misuse of the moment?
Yes. The big Tom Henry, who was the editor of the Manchester Evening News, had built his newspaper up to be a huge success by the directness and terseness. So I was just fresh from university. So I was writing editorials, and I would spend 15, 20 minutes on the first paragraph. I thought, that's rather good. I've used this metaphor, I've done this simile. And I went up. When the proof came down from Big Tom, the entire first paragraph had gone. He said, get to the point. Get to the point. I was mortified. But every time when I was writing something that was kind of long-winded, I was hearing his voice in my ear, get to the point, get to the point. Get, like a railway train, get to the point, get to the point, get to the point.
When I have to edit other people's writing, I think the same thing. Often cut out an awful lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Just get to the point. But you also came to teach in Southeast Asia. Do you learn a lot about using the language well when you're teaching somebody who speaks a foreign language?
Well, it sounds as though I invented this, but it's true. I was standing in a garden in Delhi with Pandit Nehru. And I've been brought over from England to see if the Indian newspapers, which had been taught by imperialistic Britons on subjects of complete irrelevance to the Indian villager, could be made to speak more directly to the concerns that matter to the Indian people or the Filipino people or the South Koreans and the Japanese, actually. All these places I went to couldn't understand the language, but I got the translations, and I said, this can be more concise, this is our answer. And so I learned a lot, and, you know, I really love being with the Indians who have a passion for language, which often comes out as kind of extra eloquence. But I did learn a lot there in that process.
And you say you also learned a lot from learning how to ski. How does skiing connect it to language?
I was very resentful when I reached the age of 42, and my late wife and I went up skiing, and I couldn't do it. And this seemed to me a terrible thing, because I was an athlete. I was captain of athletics at college, and here I couldn't do this elementary thing. Elementary? So I bought a very good book on skiing, and it told me what to do with my right elbow, my knee, my shoulder, my midriff, my back end, when I was paralyzed with fear at the top of a mountain. I couldn't remember what I was supposed to do with the left ear, never mind the right ear and the knee. So I thought, well, there must be a simpler way of putting this. And so I took a group of Sunday Times writers and graphic artists and photographers, and we all went through the courses with a Scottish disciplinarian, and at the end of the book, we only wrote at what we could understand and what we could say to somebody. Now, make sure at this point you push forward with both knees. Okay, that's enough for the moment. Thank you.
And the book was called We Learn to Ski.
And it was a huge success. It was actually sold 800,000 copies, I was told.
Well, the book we are talking about from Harold Evans is Do I Make Myself Clear? Why Writing Well Matters. It's published by Little Brown. And we will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Harold Evans, whose latest book is Do I Make Myself Clear? Why Writing Well Matters. It's published by Little Brown. You were the editor of the Sunday Times in London. For people in this country who have no idea about the significance of that, at least at that time, the Sunday Times was perhaps the most respected paper, at least weekend paper, in England?
Oh, certainly. Well, it had a circulation of 1.5 million. It was staffed, with one exception, with very brilliant people.
And who was the exception?
I was the exception. So I leaned on them a lot to write clearly. But the most important thing we did, which I was certainly with them 100%, was to investigate. For instance, there's a film on Netflix at the moment called Attacking the Devil. And that's about how we came to the rescue of thalidomide children without a leg or an arm or whatever it may be. And it took us 8 years to solve. That was the Sunday Times at its best, and we had the freedom to do that because, one, we were profitable and successful, but, two, we had an ownership that encouraged truth.
Should I assume that anyone who was hired by the Times didn't require much editing?
No. All of us, one of the universal truths, and I'm not quoting Jane Austen now, is that all writers need editing. Mm-hmm. And all the best writers can admit that. I know the argument about Hemingway is how many times he wrote the last page of Farewell to Arms. So we all need editing. And when I wrote an editorial at the Sunday Times, I'd give it to one of my colleagues. And the colleague would expect me to comment on his editorial.
Well, you mentioned Hemingway. You also were at Random House for 7 years, where you were the editor-in-chief. But what happens when you have a writer like Norman Mailer or E.L. Doctorow? Can you tell them that they've got to do some serious editing?
Well, yes. I mean, they were so brilliant. I mean, I was remarking once to Doctorow, Jason Epstein was his line editor. More than that, Jason Epstein was a genius in publishing. And the point is, I said to Ed, I wonder where this story's going at the water. And he said, you know... Edgar Doctorow. And a genius, brilliant man. It was so... I wish he was with us today. It was so out of suit at these Trumpian times of ours. So he said, well, it's like driving a car. The headlights, you can do the whole journey if you just follow the headlights and don't try and see where you're going beyond that, following that instruction. No, Norman Mailer was marvellous. Of course, you can't possibly expect to win an argument with Norman Mailer because he had such knowledge, such gusto, and such ferocity. So around the edges, I was president and publisher, not editor-in-chief, and got off, succeeded that title. And Jason was really the editor-in-chief. I was president and publisher. I had the responsibility of saying, we're going to back this book by this obscure community organizer called, what's his name again?
Barack Obama.
Okay, well, we'll back it. Yeah, because it reads very well, but nobody knows him. And it became, of course, one of the most important books ever published, for which the credit goes to Peter Osnos and the people working with him.
Now, you said that your favorite job was line editing. When you're the president of a publishing company, do you still do some line editing?
Do it. I am a repeat offender. I mean, wherever you go, if you were giving me a bus ticket, I'm going to edit the small print. I cannot stop. It's a compulsion. Help, help. I mean, it's like that famous cartoon of Northcliffe. When I took over the Times, I took over the London Daily Times, I framed a cartoon of Northcliffe message in which one of the editor of the Times is being made to say, hold me fast, I feel the demons of sensation arriving within me. That's how I was. I had to be held down fast.
Well, the Daily Times had a reputation for not ever doing a recap on a story. You had to be totally up on the news. Every day, it just assumed that you knew everything about what was going on up to that point. No other newspaper would dare to do that.
No, it was a first-class paper, always was. I'd had some bad times during the interwar years. It was supporting Hitler and would not allow anything to be published which would upset Herr Hitler.
Wow.
But after it was bought by Roy Thomson and William Rees-Mogg was the editor, it had a good period, and I was very honored to be editor of the Daily Times.
Why do you prefer the English word full stop to the American period?
Well, let's just ask our audience here. If you hear the word period, what do you think of? Do you think of the end of a sentence, or do you think of menstruation? What do you think of? It's a completely misleading expression.
Well, when I was a proofreader, we used to say point at the end of
Point I would accept. Point's okay, and I was being a proofreader too, so I've seen the use of the word point. But I like full stop because it says it's much like a loud voice in you. Stop, you've gone far enough.
You tell an amazing story about the University of Nebraska in 1882. Who was Lucius Adelmo Sherman?
He was a brilliant young man, lost his wife soon after he married her, and he devoted his life to the study of language, and in particular to the length of sentences, what he called predication, and traced how the number of words had declined in literature to be shorter sentences, and why it was that that increased comprehension. So you see him starting with 50-word sentences and then gradually coming to the modern period when a 14-word sentence, and of course now it's tolerable to have a 2- or 3-word sentence. Yeah. You know, women and children first. Not anything more convoluted than that.
But Conrad could write a sentence that went on for 2 pages and you understood every word. Oh. Faulkner did something similar.
Oh, yes.
But Hemingway changed it all?
Hemingway's about writing said, there's nothing to it. All you do is sit down at a typewriter and bleed. Well, that's true. But of course, you get a genius like Faulkner. I'm not arguing for curtailing sentences when there's something being said with clarity and with wit and with good imagery. I'm not arguing against that. I'm talking about most communication when you're trying to get over something simply and not confusing it too much in a way. It's a great writer. When I do my pencil editing, for instance, I'm telling a story in the book of Bernard Levin, he's a wonderful writer, and he gave me a sentence of 167 words. All I wanted was one tiny point. And we argued and argued. I said, you know, you like going through a Venetian palace, and by the time you get to the masterpiece at the end, your feet are tired and you've got to sit down. That's the point you've reached with this sentence.
How important are the rules of grammar or proper syntax to the goal of clear writing? Because you write that you thought Donald Trump was an effective communicator during the presidential campaign, and he does not always follow the rules of grammar.
No.
Or spelling, for that matter.
What frightened me was actually the clarity of his language for a bad purpose, in my view, a bad purpose. We've got to build a wall. We've got to build a wall. A wall to work. Walls work. We've got to build a wall. Walls work. And USA Today. USA. And so that was going on. At the same time, that simple language, when used to explain something else, like, for instance, if you take his explanation of climate change, it's almost impossible to understand. This is what he says about climate change. I believe there's weather. I believe there's change. And I believe it goes up, and it goes down, and it goes up again. And it changes depending on years and centuries. But I'm not a believer, and we have much bigger problems. Thanks for a non-contribution to the advancement of science. And so the problem with Donald Trump, of course, as everybody knows, that he's a serial liar. But I want to remind you, I'd just like to give you an insight into how this is dangerous. And this is a quotation from a writer. He has never yet considered whether any proposition were true or false, but whether it were convenient for the present minute or company to affirm or deny it. Right? You're with me? So then if you think to refine upon him by interpreting everything he says as we do dreams, by the contrary of what he's saying, you are still to seek and find yourself equally deceived, whether you believe or not. The only remedy is to suppose that you have heard some inarticulate sounds without any meaning at all. Now, the man who wrote that was Jonathan Swift, Gulliver's Travels. So
pretty
there
good writer.
You have it in a different style of language. The same point, that you're actually facing something which is basically incomprehensible.
You are critical of the use of the passive tense.
Yes.
Tell us why you also don't like adjectives or adverbs, or I guess the what you also call the zombification of
the nouns. Zombification, yes. Get me to understand this right. Let's just define the zombie first. Helen Sore, a professor in New Zealand, defined zombie as when a noun swallows a verb. So instead of, I authorize Leonard Lepote to do so-and-so, the authorization for Mr. Lepote to speak was signed by, you add words, same as you do with the passive voice. When you use the passive voice, here's a sentence in the passive voice. The moon was landed on by Neil Armstrong. Okay. What's the active voice? Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. Mm-hmm. So the passive voice always breathes extra syllables, words, always. And it also, it's a fantastically effective way of evading responsibility. So analyze the story of the underpant bomber, and the refrain there is, steps were taken. What do you mean, steps? Who did what? What was the effect? Mistakes were made. Coffee was served. or the notice on a board when I was in a business community. The directors have decided they will meet the... Anyway, the point is I don't want to go on. There are so many examples.
Are split infinitives and ending a sentence with a preposition still considered bad form?
Well, I tell you what. I do prefer honesty to pay instead of honesty paying off. I don't like adding the... I mean, my example, of course, is the fact that many of these propositions get it added on by people who are not... English is not their first call. I mean, Mark Twain has this wonderful sentence about a German is a man who dives into the Atlantic and emerges at the other side with the verb in his mouth. Okay, I changed that. Because I say a German is a man who dives into the Atlantic and that the other side with the verb in his mouth emerges with the German preference for ending at the end.
They end the sentence with the verb.
I love these permutations of English and all of us. I'm not a linguist. I mean, my rudimentary French would get you arrested in any port. But nonetheless, I find, you know, Madame Bovary, for instance, I love the story of Madame Bovary.
You have to tell it quickly because we're out of time.
Okay, well, he used to read his stuff to the flower, so that was a very effective way of deciding whether you'd written anything intelligible or not.
Am I being too picky when I object to media being used as a singular or people mixing up less and few?
I wouldn't be too picky. I mean... I always prefer to say fewer and so on, but I get rebuked by some modernists, so I go cautiously around strict rules like that, which don't impede my real meaning.
Harold Evans, his latest book is Do I Make Myself Clear? Why Writing Well Matters. It is published by Little Brown. And as always, it's been a great pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
These days, when we don't know something, or are curious about something, or looking for a specific article, video, or website, we're likely to check into a search engine. But it turns out that the searches we type into, most of them have another function. They can be used to study our behaviors. In his book called Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Reveals About Who We Really Are, New York Times correspondent and data specialist Seth Stevens-Davidowitz reveals how big data know who we really are. It's published by Day Street, and I'm very pleased to welcome Seth Stevens-Davidowitz to our show today. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
When did we start using the term big data?
I'd have to look at the Google searches to figure that out, but I think it was only about a few years ago.
How was big data collected in the past?
Data in the past tended to be surveys, right? If you wanted to know what people were doing, you'd ask them, or what people wanted, why people did the things they did, what they're going to do, you conducted a survey. But now there are new sources of data, which is just the trails that everybody leaves as they go through life.
And you say surveys are not always the best way to really find out what's going on.
Exactly. So people lie to surveys. If you ask people, are you going to vote in an election? before an election, or you ask people immediately after an election, did you vote? A huge percentage of Americans lie. They say they voted or will vote.
But sociologists and psychologists also have been interested in collecting data. Do they have better systems, better approaches?
I think they haven't really had a system better than asking people. They've tried a whole bunch of stuff, but it didn't really work. But they didn't have the internet for most of the history of these fields.
And computers really help us collect and interpret things.
Exactly. And there are certain sources such as Google searches where people are more honest than they've really ever been to, as far as I can tell, anybody in history. People tell Google things that they don't tell to friends, family members, themselves even.
When you say they tell it, they're searching for information. Now, someone like me who uses Google and other search engines to help prepare for guests for interviews must really confuse Google because I'm all over the place.
I think there are the data is not perfect. I talk a lot about health in the book, and definitely most of the searches for symptoms are from patients suffering from those symptoms, but some are from researchers or doctors. So it's not perfect, but it is pretty accurate on average.
How does someone become a data specialist these days?
Well, I kind of just invented the job for myself. I did my PhD in economics.
And then you worked for Google for a while?
I worked for Google for a while, yeah.
And what were you doing there?
I was doing a lot of some advertising analysis and similar stuff.
Weren't you a quantitative analyst?
Yeah, I think that was
what
my
is
official,
that?
official title. It's kind of just building models to try to figure out what people are going to do.
And why did you leave?
I wanted to write this book. I signed the book contract. I wanted to work on that full time.
Do all of the search engines, Bing, Quora, Dogpile, collect data in the same way?
They all, to some degree, do. I think Google's is more organized because they've been collecting it for a longer period of time.
Don't a few like DuckDuckGo and Ixquick offer more privacy?
I think so. The data I use is anonymous and aggregate, so I don't think it's a big privacy issue. But there are services that erase your searches as soon as you put them in the computer.
Getting back to the surveys, you say there are three reasons people lie on surveys, which of course then makes them unreliable. What are the reasons?
Well, I think one of them is you don't have an incentive to tell the truth. So there's kind of no reason for you to ever be honest on a survey. So people lean in the direction of making themselves look good. I think another reason is people are in a habit of lying. So you tell your partner that he or she looks great, or the meal is great, or things that aren't always true, and those behaviors carry over to surveys. And then also people lie to themselves a lot. So if you're lying to yourself, you can't be honest to a survey.
And aren't there some people who are more likely to even respond to a survey than others?
Yeah. Survey response rates are now below 10%. So it's getting – I think surveys are getting worse and worse. There's also an increasing number of people who mess with surveys, particularly teenagers.
Just have fun?
They did a study of the connection between adoption and negative behaviors, such as drinking alcohol, and they found a large correlation that teenagers who were adopted drank more alcohol. And they did a follow-up study, and they found that it was totally unreliable because a large percentage, more than half of the teenagers who said they were adopted, weren't really adopted. They just thought it was humorous to tell a survey that they were adopted.
What's a social desirability bias?
That's the general idea of why you can't trust surveys, that people try to make themselves look good. So they say that they exercise more than they do, or that they vote more than they do.
Unless they're teenagers.
Unless they're teenagers, in which they say they're adopted or they're 8 foot tall or have a one leg. That's a popular answer among teenagers. But for older people, generally just give a socially acceptable answer rather than the true answer.
So getting back to Google, you say it can be used to collect and analyze data on people's real preferences. Their searches are more reliable than surveys. That means forget about me, but when somebody is using it, are you aware that it's one person?
No, so the data is all anonymous and aggregate. You just know the total number of searches, although they do eliminate data if it's the same person making the same search over and over again.
But as I understand it, one of the reasons for collecting this data is to direct ads to people. So you have to know that it's me and not the next person if you're sending a certain kind of ad.
Yeah, so internally they may know that, but externally for the research, it's all anonymized and aggregated.
So it's not just for – they're not using it just strictly for advertising purposes?
Well, I think at some point they realized how powerful the data was for research purposes, and they made it available to researchers.
And what information do you get from analyzing people's Google searches?
Basically, the world doesn't work how I thought it worked. I've kind of found that over and over again. So one example I talk about in the book is racism, how much racism there is in the United States. Even though if you ask people in a survey, are you racist, the overwhelming majority of Americans, 98-99% of Americans say, of course not, I'm not racist. Like, how could you ask such a ridiculous question? But in the privacy of their own home, Americans make racist searches with shocking frequency.
And what is a racist search like?
Well, I can't use the language on NPR, but you can imagine, think of jokes humiliating African Americans. That's the most prominent theme of racist searches is humor mocking black people. And one of the things that was really surprising to me was not just how frequent these searches were made, but they were made in parts of the country that I wouldn't have guessed. So I would have thought before I had started this research that racism would be predominantly concentrated in the Deep South. If you think of our country's history, we usually think of the racism divide as a South versus North divide. And it definitely is high among the places with among the highest racist search rates include Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama. But right up there with them is Western Pennsylvania and Eastern Ohio, Industrial Michigan, Upstate New York. The real divide of racism these days is not North versus South, it's East versus West.
Although perhaps it's also a matter of quality. The other day, it was reported that a Mississippi legislator suggested that we lynch anyone who tries to take down one of the Confederacy monuments. Lynching is, I'm assuming, is part of, is one of the ways that you discover somebody is a race.
Well, I think that's kind of an extreme racism that, and I think in many parts of the South, there's more openness with racism where you can say a statement like that and not realize that you shouldn't. But I think many parts of the North have just as much racism and it affects their behaviors just as much, but they're not going to say it out loud.
Didn't racist searches increase after President Obama's speech about rejecting discrimination in lieu of the shooting in San Bernardino?
Yeah, so one of the things you see with this Google search data, you can break it down minute by minute, and you can see how people are responding to external events. And again, this is kind of the main theme of my book. I guess everybody lies, that basically you can't trust the things we've traditionally thought. So I talk about in the book about this speech that Obama gave to quell Islamophobia after the San Bernardino attack. And it was a beautiful, moving speech that got rave reviews. But if you track the minute-by-minute searches, just about everything Obama did made them more and more angry.
My guest is Seth Stevens Davidowitz. His book, Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. What can collecting these racist tendencies help us understand?
Well, I think, so the first step is just that these attitudes exist in larger numbers than we probably thought, and they predict a lot of behavior, whether it's opposition to Barack Obama or support for Donald Trump. These racist searches correlate very, very strongly.
So they tell us about, they can predict voting patterns?
And explain voting patterns, but I think that's not the most interesting use of this data. I think the more exciting use of this data is to learn how to change attitudes.
Well, since this data was collected, then why did so many people predict Donald Trump would lose the election?
Well, I said he'd win, so I think that does suggest once more how you can't trust surveys. That a lot of people said they were going to vote for Hillary Clinton, but then actually voted for Donald Trump.
What did you find when you analyzed racist patterns throughout the United States by using search histories?
Well, that basically you're going to be able to predict a lot of behaviors. And I think one of the things, there's this big paradox in America, and this has been a huge theme of sociologists and psychologists, which is if you do studies on how African Americans are treated and how white people are treated, just about every study shows that there's racism, discrimination against black people. So in jury decisions or in police stops or in many, many other areas of life or in voting, Americans still show a preference for white people relative to black people, employment decisions, all kinds of areas.
Does this cut across party affiliation?
Yeah, across party affiliation. But the paradox is if you ask Caucasian Americans, if you ask white Americans, are you racist, just about everyone says no. So the answer historically for the last 20 years, the predominant answer has been that this thing called implicit bias, that you, me, everybody listening on the radio, all of us have some subconscious discrimination and prejudice towards African Americans. So even if we're not consciously aware of it, we will be discriminatory. I think what some of this research suggests, these racist searches, is that explicit racism that people hide because it's socially unacceptable may be playing a bigger role in discrimination. There's nothing implicit about the searches I was studying.
So if I were searching for information about a white supremacist group, it probably would not suggest that I was a white supremacist unless I just kept on going at it or I didn't write the book that search would have suggested I was researching?
I think not everybody. It could be the most, and people can read the book to find the actual searches I'm talking about, which are pretty vile and not necessarily searches one would make for a research reason. But some the most vile search in the world, you don't know for sure why someone made that search. I certainly, when I was researching this book, made a lot of horrible searches. Just for research purposes, but this is a small percentage of searches, and it gets washed out in the data.
People have been calling in with questions. A listener asks if he has multiple users at home using the internet on different devices. Is the data aggregated?
Yeah, so it's aggregated at the city level or time level. So we don't know for sure what any individual is doing. We just know what lots of people are doing.
And later we're going to talk about employment, but a listener saw a recent ad for a Google search cleaning service so prospective employers can't see your searches. How public is the data, really? Can employers access your searches that easily?
The employers employers cannot access your Google search history, so that I think is a myth. I think people are a little paranoid about what employers know about them. I think social media data employers can use because it's all public, so you definitely want to be careful there. But employers can't use your Google search history.
Well, even though it's on a company computer.
Oh, if you're working at a particular company, then they can see what you're doing at the company's computer. But that's different. They can't see the past searches you made when they're deciding whether to hire you.
Seth Stevens Davidowitz. His book, Everybody Lies, has a foreword by Steven Pinker, subtitled Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. It is published by Day Street, and we'll continue our conversation after this. We are back with Seth Stevens Davidowitz. His book, Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. It's published by Day Street. You mentioned earlier that we can learn an awful lot about health by looking at what people write into search engines. Don't doctors hate it when you come to them after you have kind of researched yourself and come up with a a diagnosis of what's wrong with you?
Well, I think one thing we can do with this data is learn things that even doctors don't know. So I talk about a study in the book about pancreatic cancer. And this was by researchers at Columbia and Microsoft. They studied the same users, anonymous and de-identified over time. And some of the users, they could tell, just got a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. Because when people get diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, they search something like, just diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, what do I do? And then they studied their searches in the months leading up to that diagnosis, the symptoms that they had searched.
This is Microsoft doing it off their Bing
search data. And they found really, really subtle patterns to the point that if you have indigestion followed by abdominal pain, that's a risk factor in pancreatic cancer.
But
if you have indigestion alone, that's not a risk factor. And that's a subtle pattern that even doctors didn't know. And it's only available thanks to the huge numbers of data points that Microsoft could mine.
Would it be ethically acceptable for Microsoft, Bing, or Google to suggest to people who are searching certain symptoms that they may have pancreatic cancer?
I think, yeah, that's kind of a big question. For me personally, I would want to know that. Maybe you should have an opt-in that you should say that, you know, if you don't want to be told about potential diseases you have, you don't have to be told. But if you want to be, you can be told, because pancreatic cancer, the earlier you are told, the higher your survival rate goes.
You spend a lot of time talking about sexuality in this book. What did you find out looking at Google searches concerning sexuality?
Yeah,
you can say on the air that the FCC isn't going to get upset about.
I don't know the exact rules of the FCC, but I'll try my best.
I think it's seven words you can't say. That's pretty much it.
Okay. So there are lots of things in the data. So one of the studies I do is with homosexuality, and this probably isn't so surprising. But if you compare where people say they're gay, there are way more openly gay people in California than Mississippi, in places where it's easy to be gay than places where it's hard to be gay. But if you see gay porn searches, they're almost the same everywhere. So the gay men in Mississippi, they exist. They're just in the closet. I think that's kind of the first step. It's probably not so shocking. But then you find that a lot of people have desires that we didn't even know about. Sexuality gets pretty strange. I don't like using that word, but
they're looking up things that their loved ones may be shocked to know they're interested in.
Yeah, in big numbers, like the mainstream things that people search, in pornography, is I think pretty shocking. Like the common searches, the common desires, not even just fringe stuff.
And how can we use that? Why does it even matter if somebody has satisfies kinky thoughts by looking up, watching certain things on their computer rather than acting them out on them?
Well, I think I don't know that there's a huge use case except curiosity. Like, I think sexuality has always been an interest to a lot of people, so. It is interesting to learn the truth about these areas, but I don't think there's anything wrong with people having whatever desire they have.
What did you find when you started analyzing the English language?
So one of the things that I talk about in the book a lot is that data has changed. We used to think of data as, you know, with a survey which people take, it's kind of a checkbox, right? Yes, no. Numbers, it's very, very structured. And now data is much more unstructured, including the words that people use. That's now a big source of data.
And it turns out that men and women use different linguistics?
Yeah, so you can compare using all the Facebook posts, what words men and women use more. And some of them are definitely not surprising. Men, one of the words, among the words most disproportionately used by men are football and Xbox, probably not gonna shock anybody. But one of the things I found kind of interesting is that among the most disproportionately used words by men are a whole bunch of curse words, which surprised me because I grew up around a lot of women who freely threw around F-bombs and stuff. But that's actually a male trait, cursing.
And what are the words that women are most likely to use?
So with two O's, like so. And then so with three O's, like so. And then so with like four O's, so. The more O's, the more likely it's a woman in the so.
Men are not.
They don't add O's to their so's, yeah.
How do you analyze how searches relate to unemployment rates?
Yeah, well, this is a study. I was looking at whether you can predict the unemployment rate based on the searches people make. And I assumed if listeners want to guess at home what would be the searches most correlate with the unemployment rate, what I would have guessed is unemployment benefits or new jobs or unemployment help, unemployment assistance. But the single search most highly correlated was, I think, a word that I can't use on NPR, but was a pornographic site, which is kind of makes sense that when people are not out of work, they're basically looking at more porn. So that's the highest correlation with the unemployment rate.
During times of high unemployment, are searches such as unemployment job search typically?
Yeah, they are searched, but not as much as the porn searches.
So they just have time on their hands.
Yeah, exactly. Solitaire is also something they search a lot in the PG realm when they have when they're unemployed.
So they're playing solitaire on their computer.
Yeah.
Kill time.
Yeah.
When Netflix asked its members what they would want to watch in the future, what did they say?
Yeah, this kind of goes to the theme of the book, Everybody Lies, that you can't trust what people say, and this is true in business as well. Netflix initially asked its users what movies they wanted to watch in the future. So right now they were watching this movie, but what do you want to see this coming Saturday or this coming Sunday? And when you ask people that question, they tend to say very highbrow films. They talk about, they say they're going to want to watch the 16th century Russian documentary or the clever new French film. And then Saturday comes around, Netflix showed them all these videos, and they all ignored them and went back to the same lowbrow comedies or romance flicks that they'd always watched. So Netflix kind of realized you have to just ignore what people tell you and just build algorithms to predict what they're actually going to see.
On the other hand, those algorithms often are wrong for me. They say, you may also want to watch such and such, and no, I don't want to watch those.
They're not perfect, but they're probably better than your own predictions of what you're going to see, which also are highly imperfect.
Seth Stevens Davidowitz, his book, Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are, is published by Day Street. Can we use social media sites such as Facebook to analyze data about people?
I think we can, and there are some interesting findings. I talk about in the book how you can predict what makes people like a baseball team or what causes people to have certain political views when they're adults or buy certain products. But I think we have to be really, really careful with Facebook because, you know, if people lie to surveys, and they do, they lie way more to Facebook because they have an incentive to look good to their friends rather than tell the truth.
So Facebook posts and shares are actually revealing what we want people to think about us?
Yeah. So I call Google searches digital truth serum, and then Facebook posts are digital brag to my friends about how good my life is serum. That people just exaggerate how intellectual they are, exaggerate how happy they are, exaggerate how good their relationships are, exaggerate how rich they are, basically exaggerate everything to impress their friends.
The same sort of thing that they might say to a dating website.
Yeah, that's another notoriously unreliable source of data.
Did you use any Facebook data for this book?
Yeah, I did. I did a bunch of studies with it, but I tried to do it in areas where people wouldn't necessarily be embarrassed.
So how is Facebook using the information people disclose on their page as well as in their posts and likes?
Well, one thing that all these companies do that some people aren't aware of is called A/B testing. And that is that you can do a small experiment, a small controlled experiment. You put some people into a control group, some people into a treatment group, and you show them different versions of the site. So one group may get a different font or a different color or a different text.
And font and color matter?
They do. They sometimes can matter enormously. And then the data scientists at Facebook or any of these companies basically analyze which one gets people to click more or stay on Facebook longer. And because they're all using computers, it's all automated, they can do these really, really fast. Facebook does more experiments in a single day than the FDA does an entire year. And then this is one of the reasons that some of these sites have gotten so addictive, that they just keep on doing these tests, finding which one wins and changing the site to make it more and more powerful.
And do we know what kinds of fonts appeal more? Is it serif or sans serif fonts?
One of the things you learn is that there's not a general lesson. You want to be careful. One of the reasons experimentation has proven so valuable to businesses is that there aren't really general lessons. You just have to keep trying different things. And some things work for a while and stop working. Some things work under certain conditions and not others. But you keep on testing, you find the best combinations.
In social media, people tend to surround themselves with others who have similar views. Does that apply to when they're going online as well?
Well, there's a myth that the online world is segregating us, is creating these filter bubbles where liberals hang out only with liberals, conservatives only with conservatives. It is true that online you tend to surround yourself with people who share your political views. But that's true offline, too. And in fact, it's true even more offline, that people have friends who share their political views, coworkers who share their political views, dinner party companions who share their political views. It turns out you're actually more likely to come across somebody with opposing views online rather than offline.
It sounds to me like a lot of the things that we discover when we collect all this data is that not only are people more complicated than we would like to believe, but they're also more screwed up sometimes than we would like to believe.
I think that's right. I think a lot of people ask me, how has it changed me to spend 5 years analyzing the darkest and weirdest thoughts that human beings have, namely the Google searches that people make? And there have been parts that have been depressing and really disturbing, and I've researched child abuse and do-it-yourself abortions, people in real trouble in life. And that is, you know, that's really hard and you know, can make me really depressed. But I think there's also this part where you learn of people's anxieties and insecurities and struggles. And that's actually, I think, made me kind of happier because I feel less alone. You're constantly bombarded with lies about how easy other people find life. So there's something comforting in finding you're not alone in your vulnerability.
No, you're at the New York Times now. You used to be at Google.
Yeah, that's right.
How do you apply what you learned at Google to your job at the New York Times?
A lot of it is data analysis, data journalism. So I use the same tools that I was using at Google, but to try to tell stories that people find interesting about who we are.
Now, can't some of this data be used against us? For example, aren't banks using data to decide who or who shouldn't get a loan?
Yeah. So the study I talk about is a study of peer-to-peer lending on this site Prosper. And to get a loan on Prosper, you apply. You say why you need that loan. And data scientists found out you can predict whether someone will pay back the loan based on the words they use in that loan application. And some of them
just
are
just the words. What kinds of words?
Some of them are bizarre. If you say "I promise," you're way less likely to pay back, which goes to the point that everybody lies. Like that's one of the biggest indicators. I'm not going to pay back if you say "I promise." And one of them that is maybe even stranger is if you use the word "God," you're much less likely to pay back. Much more likely to default. About 2.2 times more likely to default if you include God in the loan application. So someone would basically make money by not giving a loan to anybody who said "God bless you" or you know "I swear to God" or anything like that. And that's kind of disturbing because there are perfectly honest people who just unwittingly say this without realizing that the algorithms are grouping them in with people who are less reliable.
I wonder how psychologists would interpret all of that, the word "promise" or using God.
I think it's interesting. There are kind of two parts to data. There's predictive analytics. So Google and Facebook and a lot of these companies are much more interested in prediction than explanation. They tend not to care why things correlate. They just know that things correlate and can make more money knowing these correlations. But then social scientists and psychologists and sociologists are more interested in the why question. So yeah, what does it tell us about society that people who mention God or people who mention a relative, that's another one. If you mention a brother or a sister, a mother or father in a loan application, you're much less likely to pay back. My brother's in the hospital, less likely to pay back.
But as you point out, that can also be discriminatory because somebody who would be willing to pay back the loan, would probably pay back the loan, might use those words and be rejected and not understand why.
If you think about the current legal framework, for most of the last century, really, companies have known 5 to 10 things about a person. They may know the person's race, they may know the person's address, they may know the person's income or net worth or home ownership, and then the laws are there to we have laws in place to say which of these factors can a company consider. They can't consider race, they can't consider religion, they can consider home ownership or income or these factors. But now we're living in a world where companies know a million things about you. They know the words you use, they know the things you like on Facebook, they know all your social media activity ever, they know maybe things you've clicked on, they know so much about you. And I think the ethical and legal system is not really prepared for big data.
Can't companies also manipulate Google? They have found ways to get their thing at the top of the Google search?
It's kind of a constant battle between Google and companies to get to the top. But in general, Google tends to win that because they have really, really good engineers who make certain that people get the sites they want. There are actually complications to this. And talk about the darkness of the world. For a while, when people made searches about suicide, looking for information about suicide, obviously a really, really dark, disturbing topic. And actually, you can predict when suicides are high when people are making a lot of these searches. So a lot of people do go through with it. I mean, it's really disturbing. But for a while, when people made these searches, among the top returns were message boards with people saying, like, you should kill yourself, or like, here's how to do it. Like, really, really nasty, dark stuff that the web has kind of unleashed. And Google had a policy of not messing around with the results, that it was all an algorithm. But in this case, they realized they couldn't just let the algorithm show people who are thinking about suicide these nasty comments from crazy people on message boards saying to do it. So they changed the algorithm to make sure that people
do it. It's like saying jump if somebody's...
Exactly. So, I mean, they're just crazy people. For whatever reason, the formula, a lot of people are clicking on this, and for whatever reason, Google's algorithms had this near the top, and they realized this is insane. We have to have right at the top suicide hotlines and information from professionals to stop people from doing this.
A listener called in to say that he'd noted a recent study that people who purchased or searched for birdseed were also more reliable when paying back loans.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
yeah. So
birdseed of all things.
Of all things. So that's one of the strangest things about big data, that the correlation between anything is almost never 0.00000. Right. Everything you do has some correlation with something else you do. So there are all these strange correlations that people who like curly fries tend to be more intelligent, or people who search birdseed payback loans, they're out there.
Just one more thing. Does this mean that we no longer are going to even bother relying on polls or surveys?
I don't think polls are going out of business. I think they're just going to take a smaller and smaller they're going to make a smaller part, much smaller part of how we explain the world.
My guest, Seth Stevens Davidowitz, is a New York Times op-ed contributor, a visiting lecturer at the Wharton School, and former Google data scientist. He has written a book called Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. It has a foreword by Steven Pinker, and it is published by Day Street. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me, Leonard.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.